and welcome to episode 14 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zoutra. Well, I am very pleased to introduce our guest for today's episode, Dr. Thomas Polger. Tom is professor of philosophy, fellow of the graduate school, and head of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Cincinnati. He is the past president of the Southern Society for Philosophy and Psychology and past secretary treasurer of the Society for Philosophy and Psychology. Tom's work spans philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, and metaphysics. He is interested in the sciences of the mind and the things they study, and he approaches such questions by studying the relationships between explanations, models, and entities of different sciences, especially those of the cognitive and brain sciences. So as Tom sees it, the questions that arise around the cognitive and brain sciences amount to a special case of the general puzzle of why we have various sciences rather than just one. Why is there anything but physics? In the process of investigating questions about minds, brains, and sciences, we may come to wonder about the kinds of theorizing that we do and about the evidence and arguments that we employ. So two overarching questions for Tom are, how do the methods of philosophy fit with other forms of inquiry, and how is philosophical knowledge even possible? Before he was a philosopher, Tom was a camp counselor, dishwasher, information systems consultant, juggler, and fire eater, not in that order. He currently lives in Cincinnati, Ohio, with his wife, triplets, and dog. And when he is not doing philosophy, he cooks, reads sci-fi and fantasy novels, he watches movies, and he dabbles in graphic design. So Tom's is a name I frequently heard coming up in the philosophy of cognitive science. And in fact, when I was first chatting with my PhD advisor, Dr. Colin Allen, on who is a contemporary example of someone who does good philosophy of cognitive science, Tom's name came up as one of the top names on the list. So therefore, I was very happy when he agreed to come on this podcast and share a bit of his story with us. And I must say, I was not disappointed in our conversation. I thought it was very fun. It was very engaging. And I think you'll enjoy it. So without further ado, let's bring in Tom. Thomas, Tom Pol, Tom, you go by Tom?
Tom. All right. Tom Polger, yes.
Tom Polger. Oh, well, yes. Welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this fine Wednesday afternoon?
I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, thank you very much. Where are you, so where are you calling us from, or where am I calling you from, I suppose?
I am actually at my home office in Cincinnati.
Oh, great, great. Very nice. As at the University of Cincinnati, is that
That's
right?
That's correct.
And, well, yeah, your home office. Okay, cool, cool. Do you do most of your work in the home office?
I think the answer is probably yes, although I'm the department head of my department, so I'm sort of sharing time back and forth between more administrative things on campus and trying to do more philosophy at home.
Okay. And is that, so department head of the Department of Philosophy?
Department of Philosophy, yep.
Cool, cool. Are you guys doing admissions right now?
How's that going? So far, so good. We've had very good applicants, and we've had good cohorts, for a long time now. So
Yeah, I happen to, I think I don't want to say I went to the universities. Never mind. That was another university I'm thinking about. We had gone, did you go to the Empirical Informed Philosophy Conference or Empirical Philosophy of Mind Conference? I think it might have been in Louisville.
There were a couple. There was one in Louisville a year ago in the fall, but also the Southern Society for Philosophy and Psychology met in Louisville last year as well.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. And you are currently are you the president of that as well?
I'm a past president. I was president some years ago. The current president is philosopher Amy Kind.
Oh, great. Great. Okay. Well, that's good to know. Well, I'm interested to hear a little bit more about the Southern Society. I've heard very good things. Let's start back at the beginning. Tell me, Tom, where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Maryland in a suburb of Washington, D.C., sort of halfway between D.C. and Baltimore, and pretty close to Annapolis.
Okay.
And, I wasn't born there, but that was where I grew up.
Grew up in, so Maryland's the general area, the specifics, but a suburb of Maryland.
A suburb of Washington, D.C., yep, in Maryland.
Oh, cool. Well, great. How'd you like growing up there?
It was good. I think I was probably a typical suburban kid and did the usual stuff. I was not someone who had an interest in philosophy or being an academic from, age two or something like that.
Sure.
That came later. But did the usual stuff.
Cool. What were your parents up to? What was mom and dad doing?
My father was a photographic engineer, and he worked for a couple different companies, GE and others, but worked for the federal government for a while. And my mother was a high school English teacher.
Very nice. You mentioned you were not interested in the sciences or in the philosophy and normal kid things, I can imagine. What kinds of things, growing up, were you interested in?
I played a couple sports. I played soccer and baseball and, hung out with my friends a lot. Mm-hmm. And, had the usual young kid's infatuation with Legos and setting stuff on fire and blowing them up and messing around with, little electronic parts and things like that. And then, later on, we started to get simple computers, TRS-80 and things like that in schools, and got into, what now is sort of lightweight programming and so forth. But I think that's probably my first, introduction to maybe like thinking logically or thinking about minds and machines or anything like that was sort of elementary or maybe middle school introduction to computers.
Was this a course that you took in middle school, or was this like a club or something?
I think, as I remember it was mostly like after school programs and things like that. And then when I got older, our county had an arrangement with the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. Mm-hmm. And we would go and do some after school, mostly science and math stuff at the Naval Academy. So we would do after school physics or after school, programming your mathematical calculator and other sorts of lightweight programming stuff.
Was this something parents were, encouraging you to do, or is this something you found on your own?
They were certainly supportive. Sort of any kind of educational thing, but, between, my dad's interest in engineering, he certainly encouraged that sort of thing. But a lot of it was just taking advantage of the opportunities that were there for school kids in the area.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I was curious when you said as well, photographic engineer. Is this something that did you do something along with your father? Was there an interest in photography there? Did he take you on photo shoots?
No, he didn't. His background was more in photo optics and chemistry.
Okay.
But he also is an avid hobbyist photographer, and my sister and I both have that bug, but she's the one who's turned it into a career. So for me, it's just a hobby.
Oh, okay. And do you have an older or younger sister?
I have a younger sister, and she's actually a photo editor for National Geographic Online.
Wow, that's fantastic. That's like the job that every photo journalist wants, basically.
she likes it, yeah.
Cool. Well, that's great. That's good. That's cool to hear. But you found your way, it sounds like, amongst, many other things, sports, baseball, Legos, et cetera.
exactly.
Which is, it's nice to hear some of the, I relate with some of the suburban lifestyle things.
Right.
But around time, was there like an interest in the building thing, machines, building, doing sort of simple things with programming or? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I remember trying to, the first computer that we actually owned at our house was a Commodore 64. And I remember, learning to program it to do little graphics things and things like that. And then eventually trying to program it to play games against me. And, in retrospect, I'm looking back and I realized the reason it didn't work is I was, you know, trying to load more data into it than 64K could hold. But, you know, as a kid, I didn't know the technological parts of, or limits to it. So, I mean, yeah, it was, you know, we were playing lots of video games, of course, but then trying to write our own and trying to write games that would play against us.
What kind of games were out at the time?
Oh, I mean, you know, Intellivision and the original Atari 2600 were, you know, what we had when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, I think I was in college or maybe after college when like Sega Genesis and things like that came about. So everything was really pretty rudimentary compared to, you know, what happened soon after that.
Nice.
You know, it's astounding when you look back at some of those games. I mean, and they're fun. I mean, my kids love playing the emulated games of some of the original arcade games. But, you know, to believe that we looked at that and we thought, hey, that looks like a tank at the time when
yeah.
a couple of pixels here and there. But
do you remember any of the games you tried to program or tried to make to work?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I was... as I said, I have one younger sister, and she's 10 years younger than I am. Okay. So, you know, I think although I had plenty of kids in the neighborhood to play with, there was always sort of, you know, trying to find playmates and whatnot. So
yeah.
One of my favorite board games at the time was, I don't know if you know this one, Scotland Yard. It's kind of a chase board game where someone's the villain and the other players try to catch her or him. And, I love playing it, but it takes a bunch of players. So I was always trying to figure out, like, could I get the machine to play again? I think there's actually an iPad version of it now, but I haven't tried it.
Game looks pretty fun, actually. It reminds me of a computer game I used to play of solving mysteries. It might have been like they might have created some sort of a computer game, actually, of something similar to this, where you're exploring these different routes and solving essentially the mystery of.
Yeah.
Who did what? That's really, well, cool. And you're right. Yeah. So say it needs 3 to 6 players, but, yeah. Okay. So trying to get that to work.
But that, you know, like I said, at that age, I didn't appreciate that if you're trying to load in, you know, some sort of array representing, you know, myriad different routes between places on the board that I was quickly trying to exceed the storage capacity of the machine.
Yeah.
I did get into programming, and, you know, I think I, you know, had the same idea that, you know, lots of, well, science fiction writers and kids have, but scientists as well, that, oh, well, if only I could get this thing to learn, then it would really, you know, be intelligent and I could play a game with it or something like that. I think probably somehow through that I became aware that there was something called cognitive science and that you could study that. And
you ultimately did an undergraduate degree in cognitive science. I see.
I did.
Syracuse. Before that, so, you know, were there? I'm curious as to how we got to that point. You know,
yeah.
Was there? So interested in programming. Were there other kinds of things of interest, in maybe in high school years or?
Yeah, I mean, I took psychology in high school, but I wasn't very impressed with my high school psychology experience. Mm-hmm. I really liked physics, but I struggled with some of the math to continue on at doing college level physics. So,
sure.
I sort of liked. I had a great science physics teacher in high school. I wish I remembered his name, but you know. I did well with that at the time, and I really enjoyed it, but I also sort of knew that probably wasn't going to be my long-term path.
Mm-hmm.
I dabbled with, you know, basically all the different offerings that the school had. I ended up doing the AP Physics course, but, of course, like any kid, right? You had to do a certain amount of chemistry and biology and history.
Sure. And so there was consideration of maybe going into physics at a time.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some sense, I would have liked to, but also, knew that I just wasn't good enough at doing calculus, pre-calculus at that time to do it at the level that would have been needed to make a career of it.
Understandable. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you know, growing up was, and went to Syracuse. Yeah. So what was, what was your undergraduate experience like?
It was great. Yeah. Like I said, I somehow became aware that cognitive science was something like people do, that it was this sort of mishmash of stuff that I was interested in or thought I was interested in. And but there weren't a lot of programs out there. So really, I applied to some places that had programs or sort of programs and didn't get into some that I thought I would like to go to. But I also applied to places that sort of had the components separately. So when I started out at Syracuse, actually, I was a double major in computer science and linguistics. And that was my path for a year or so before I figured out, on the one hand, that that you could make a degree in cognitive science there. And also, I had the distinction of, at the end of my freshman year, I was simultaneously on the dean's list and on academic probation. I'd dropped some of the required math courses for the computer science degree, but consequentially, my GPA went up. So I was, awarded and punished at the same time.
Oh, geez. do you remember any fun projects or anything you worked on in cognitive science?
Yeah, I mean, so in the beginning, my first introduction was, computer science students all had to take logic. So, I took logic. Mm-hmm. And I found out I had a course in the history and philosophy of science that was actually part of the science sequence that I was taking, physics sequence that I was taking. And I found out from that professor that there were courses in philosophy of psychology and minds and machines and that sort of thing. And so he sent me to do that. And I think it was probably, could even have been as early as the spring of my freshman year that I took a course on minds and machines with Bob Van Gulik. Huh. And, so once I had connected with him, then I had, sort of much more guidance on what was available. And at the time, the big thing going on the sort of research side there was that the cognitive psychology group was doing some, computational modeling, connectionist modeling of computational psycholinguistics stuff, so this was early Seidenberg and McClellan things, and these kind of old Sun, the Sun Spark workstations had sort of, they were pretty novel at the time, so having that kind of computational power and being able to run these connectionist models was the big thing. So
what kinds of applications were they doing in terms of and I suppose more basic research, what they're doing with these connectionist models?
Yeah, so the person I was working, studying under most closely was Kurt Burgess, who's now at UC Riverside. And he was doing sort of the graphene to phoneme stuff and also semantic networks. It was a small group. He wasn't new there, but he was still building his career there. And I ended up, had a lot of sort of mixed graduate, undergraduate courses in cognitive psychology, and I ended up taking a bunch of those. So it was partway through that, really, that, I was the student in class saying, well, this is great that it does this transformation, but, does it really understand what it's doing? Kurt was very supportive of asking those questions, but he had no interest in answering those questions, so he sent me back over to the philosophy department if I wanted to ask those questions. Sure. And that was, fair enough.
was asking these kinds of questions a trend for you throughout life, or was this, something that kind of came about in undergraduate, more deeper meaning kinds of questions?
You know, I mean, in retrospect, I mean, I was always an inquisitive kid, and you know, as I say, growing up outside of Washington D.C., we spent a lot of time going into the Smithsonian and Air and Space Museum and and Natural History Museum, and so you know, I definitely. You know, had the proclivity to just get interested in all sorts of stuff like that. But at the time, it didn't occur to me that, you know, when I was younger, even in college, really, it didn't occur to me that these were like gigantic questions or just things. It just seemed to me like the obvious thing to ask.
Sure.
And I mean, of course, by the time I was taking classes, I knew I wasn't the first person to ask those questions. But it didn't, you know, the cognitive science mood at the time for students and you know, what you would read about in textbooks or so forth was, you know, sort of the real interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, we're all in this together. So, you know, we're going to get philosophers and psychologists and computer science in a room and you know, talk to each other.
That's really great to hear that that was going on. I think... Was that always the case, this multidisciplinary effort in cognitive science? Or
You know, I don't think it was always the case. And I think, you know, in many ways, I stumbled into a good situation at Syracuse. I mean, certainly, you know, as I say, I looked for places that had the resources in terms of degree programs or departments to pick up on the different things that I was interested in, but I had no idea, you know, to look for a particular person or, you know, is this department strong at? I mean, what I didn't even know what that would mean, really. I mean, I think largely undergrads don't, and it's probably good that they don't to some extent. You know, work at that kind of fine grainedness.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I one of the reasons I chose to go to a big university is maybe I would change my mind about what I wanted to do, and have some other options. So yeah, I think it just was really fortuitous that those people were there at that time and talking to each other. And had good relations. You know, it's certainly the case that I'm in my own university now, University of Cincinnati. Our philosophy department has a great relationship with the psychology department here, but you know, it's really built on individual relationships with people and faculty. And you know, I look back now and I realize how lucky it was that that was there. For me as an undergrad, because, you know, you certainly look around and see lots of other connections where departments are much more balkanized and people just don't know what each other are doing.
So you mentioned, and you'll hear this, that, you know, the interdisciplinary, you get a bunch of scientists and computer scientists, you know, cognitive psychologists, computer scientists, philosophers in a room and talking and making connections. And then that's what they tell you, like, make connections, do this, you know, talk to each other. But you know, that can be sometimes easier said than done. So, you know, what did you see as an undergraduate that, you know, you saw you either you yourself or the faculty with which you were learning from, you know, in terms of actions, in terms of, you know, how did they collaborate on research together? Were they starting up empirical projects together? Were they sitting down and writing, you know, philosophical papers? You know, what exactly did they do?
Yeah, so I think in my undergrad years, in many ways, as far as I know, there wasn't a lot of research level collaboration between those faculty at the time. So I think in many ways, their interaction was through training undergraduates and through, you know, certainly philosophers like Bob Angulik or like Larry Hardin was an older philosopher there at the time, but he had just published his book on color that brought a lot of empirical work on color into the philosophical debate about color perception and color ontology. And So that was just sort of in the air with the people that I was studying with. I mean, I should say that by the time I finished, although towards the end when I realized I wanted to go on and get a PhD in philosophy, I did take some philosophy in other sort of more general areas. But the vast majority of the philosophy that I had as an undergrad was philosophy of mind and philosophy of psychology. So those particular people happened to be, you know, working in an empirically oriented framework and be friendly to bringing empirical data into the classroom. I mean, I'm sure there were other members of the faculty there at the time who were not at all friendly to that.
Sure.
And I just didn't study with them. But those who were interested in mind and psychology and cognitive science, you know, they were very supportive, you know, of me, and they were, well, and not just me, right, but the students. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the interaction was through, of course, there were, you know, visiting speakers and seminars and things like that. But I think in the late 80s and the early 90s, a lot of it was, via the things that they read and how they taught and what they taught, rather than by striking up active research programs together. So it's probably more a matter of how they influenced each other's work separately rather than a full-on collaboration at that time.
Good, good. You know, I think there is something to say in terms of presently being there and somewhat directly influencing each other's work, yet not, you know, mutual collaboration exactly on each project, but just being there, being challenged by each other, having the other ones in one's, you know, forethought is, I think meaningful.
I think so, yeah.
Cool. So what convinced you then to come over to philosophy as opposed to some lucrative career in cognitive science?
Yeah. I don't
lucrative in many ways, I suppose, but why philosophy and not necessarily straight cognitive psychology or something?
Well, I think that, you know, on the one hand, initially I realized that intellectually the kinds of questions that I was interested in answering were the questions that were being asked by philosophers of mind or empirically informed. So it was sort of in the first case an institutional fact that I realized, you know, that's where those questions were being discussed.
Yep.
I would say, for me anyway, that it wasn't sort of quite final that was going to be the path. Because during my undergrad years, I started working in the summers for a not-for-profit consulting company in a different DC suburb, and doing things like interface design and mock-ups for large-scale information systems. And I loved that practical aspect of it. I mean, you asked earlier about, you know, building things and putting things together. And, of course, there's something very satisfying about, you know, when you can look at, you know, a piece of software or a demonstration or whatever, and, you know, it works. Mm-hmm. And you know that it works and it does what you want it to do. And so I was doing that sort of stuff. And so, excuse me. You know, I still think when I first went to graduate school, I thought, well, you know, I can always go back and do this other thing if I decide I don't like it. But what made me think I was going to like it, and correctly so, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I probably started to know maybe by the end of my second year in college, maybe that being a professor might be a possibility. But then I guess it must have been the spring of 1992, Bob Van Gulik did a graduate seminar on consciousness, and Dan Dennett's Consciousness Explained had just come out, and Colin McGinn's Problems of Consciousness was still pretty recent. And then there were a couple other books either in manuscript or coming out around that time. And so he had this seminar, and it was a fantastic group of people. and just really fun and rewarding. And I think it was, if I had any doubts that it sort of this was interesting to me, they definitely started to, you know, coalesce around like this would be a cool thing to do.
Sure.
around that time.
So this, yeah. So this is after. So you've transferred. Did you move from Syracuse to Duke? Was it? Did you make the shift right away, or was there some time in between?
There was time in between. So I did apply to graduate school right out of undergrad. I finished. Undergrad early, half a year early. Oh. So I sort of wasn't on the right application cycle.
Mm.
So I was applying to graduate schools when I'd really only had 3 years of college.
So not as extensive a background as maybe
not as extensive. And I think I was still pretty naive, even with good advice from faculty, still pretty naive about, you know, what one ought to say in a statement of purpose and, sure. you know, things like that for applying to grad school. And the result was I didn't get in anywhere the first time I applied. So I was waitlisted some places and other places not. But I wasn't admitted with funding anywhere that time around. So I went and, you know, worked this job that I had that I'd been working during summers. And then I had to did start working after I finished in the middle of the year anyway. So I stayed with that and applied a second time around. So it was really probably, I guess maybe like almost close to 2 years in between when I finished my undergrad and when I started grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, you know, I went in thinking, well, I can always go back and return this job if the philosophy thing doesn't work out.
What was the job? What were you working again? I'm sorry.
So the company that I worked for was called the MITRE Corporation, is called the MITRE Corporation. And they're a not-for-profit corporation chartered by the federal government to be a consultant to federal agencies.
Hmm.
And so they do a lot of technology consulting and consulting on procurement and things like that. And they also do some work with large systems design in terms of helping various federal agencies figure out you know, what they're going to do and how they're going to manage information. So we were kind of consulting company that was not so much trying to build something, because by law they can't compete with private for-profit corporations, but trying to sort of look 5 or 10 years ahead to anticipate what the government was going to need. And
I'm just on the website here. It looks like a pretty cool place to work.
it was a cool place to work, and I had great support there. And we would go out and visit various corporations in Silicon Valley once or twice a year and meet cool people and ask them, you know, what the future was going to hold for them or for their companies. And I got to keep in mind, like, I think, am I right that like December of 92 is when the World Wide Web first went online? So
sounds close to right. I maybe like it was available earlier for certain, you know,
So, I mean, things were changing rapidly, and it was definitely a cool place to be and fun to do. You know, I still had this love of cognitive science, of the research part. And so it was still relatively easy to walk away from the paycheck and go to grad school at that point. I think if I stayed out for too much longer, it would have been harder and harder to walk away from a salary and a paycheck and go back to graduate school.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, yeah, I mean, it's good experience to get and good field experience, but also having that experience that can help inform your decision to you know, go into academia.
And absolutely.
I think worthwhile. And some students coming up do have that experience and some don't. But yeah, it's good to see those that, you know, either way, I think it can be useful. But I myself had taken a little bit of time off. It's good to know. Like, I mean, it's just if anyone is thinking about I know even folks who are listening to this show who are, if they're considering, or you know, a couple of things. One, you know, taking some time off is completely fine. Not getting accepted the first time around is also fine. You know, and also going into a graduate program where you're not totally sure. I mean, that's another thing I've had met with a lot of folks, is there's this sort of expectation that you ought to know exactly that you're absolutely certain about this is the career right. path for you. And I don't think that's really true for anybody, but you have to pretend like it is.
It's not irrevocable. You know, you do have to, you know, to make sure that you know what you're getting into, but it doesn't mean you can't get out of it.
Well, of course, I'm not saying go in with some sort of like, it's a big commitment, and you certainly should understand what you're signing up for. And hopefully you do by the time you're, admitted and committing to going to a great program.
I also think, you know, one other advantage of spending some time outside academia, it's certainly not a necessary thing, but, I mean, when you do have a job in academia at a university, I mean, it's a workplace, and it's a crazy workplace. And, you hear people say things about, you know, how crazy it is at a university, and they imagine sometimes that it's very different from the business world. Of course, it is different from a business world in some ways, but in other ways, it's just like any other big company. And, you know, having seen other big companies from the inside, you sort of realize, you know, the grass isn't going to be greener. There are these kinds of fights everywhere, so...
That's really interesting. I would love to get back to that. I'm curious just to ask, in addition to hearing about your research, just academia as a workplace, that we don't talk about that much. This is sort of, it's supposed to be a place that you're not at a workplace. You're at a, you know, sort of a, people don't like to think of it as such.
I know it's a strange thing, but at the end of the day, it doesn't have to be just a job, but it is a job.
Yeah. That's a nice way of saying it. Yeah. So what were you getting up to in graduate school, moving through at Duke? I know you came in with an interest in philosophy of psychology, philosophy of mind. Were those interests getting focused, getting sharper, or were there other kinds of things happening at that time?
They were. So I did. I came in with definitely the philosophy of mind, cognitive science perspective. And as I said a moment ago, as an undergraduate in the beginning, almost all of my philosophy background was philosophy of mind and psychology. So it was only at the very end that I took some other courses in more general contemporary philosophy and in epistemology, philosophy of language. But even that's a very narrow thing. So for me, the first really big task in grad school was I knew that I knew nothing about the history of philosophy, and that I was going to have to pass three qualifying exams in three different areas of the history of philosophy. For me, the beginning years had less to do with focusing my interests as actually getting some of the breadth that my peers had that I didn't have. I had done, the only philosophy of science I did was philosophy of psychology. I didn't know about philosophy of biology, or that's not quite right. I had done some philosophy of physics, but, I didn't know about philosophy of biology or sort of general philosophy of science issues. I didn't know anything about the history of philosophy or ethics or anything like that. So it was a lot of catching up at the beginning.
I've talked to some other folks on this show who, I forget who it was, they had made it through their undergrad at Princeton, I think having majored in philosophy without ever having read a word of Kant. Which was interesting to me. So, I mean, it's, you know, and obviously the philosophy of science, there a lot of folks do come from the science backgrounds or interdisciplinary backgrounds. So, certainly it's the case that doing some catch up or just diving further into having a better background in the more traditional philosophical areas can be worthwhile.
Yeah, it was worthwhile, and it was also mandatory. So
they had to do it.
So that worked out well. But So yeah, in the beginning, it was less about focus than catching up. And the main thing that changed is that my interests went sort of not. As an undergrad, especially after this seminar I described to you on consciousness,
yeah.
I was thinking a lot about consciousness and about color and color perception and color ontology, and but I didn't have any training in metaphysics or anything like that, so it didn't have any sort of real form to me. It was and you could do that then. You could sort of just do sort of philosophy of mind was still, you know, a lot of thought experiments or intuition pumps or whatnot. Yeah. And I was not, you know, reflecting on that as a methodology or anything like that. I was just going along with the game. That,
sure. Yeah. You weren't doing philosophy of mind or something.
Yeah.
It was more just like, this stuff is, let's play with it.
Yep. Yep. So the big change, I guess, was that, you know, being exposed to other kinds of philosophy of science and I mean, certainly I wouldn't say that the consciousness, consciousness is still a huge topic. It hasn't like burned out or anything, but my initial sort of focus on consciousness per se dissipated some, and I ended up working more on sort of general questions about the ontology of minds, and that got flavored more and more with the philosophy of science perspective as I went along.
Okay. You ever make it to the Science of Consciousness conference? I think it was in University of Arizona.
Yeah, I went to a couple of those.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I went to the second and third, maybe the fourth. Yeah, those were a lot of fun.
Well, it sounds like you went out. Yeah, yeah. There are. That's a fun conference to go. My first was in 2006, but definitely helped shape my interest in philosophy of cognitive science.
And, yeah,
because you know at the time I wasn't reflecting. I had similar ways where it was just interesting stuff was happening. Well, cool. But it sounds like you know some of the shift was. In a little bit out of consciousness, but more toward maybe you could talk a little bit about you know what ended up being your dissertation project.
Yeah, no, so it was a shift out of consciousness per se, mm-hmm. in that I wasn't participating in debates about the nature of qualia,
sure,
or things like that. But on the other hand. My interest has always been in perception and sensation. So for me, I was less interested in questions about representation or intentional content or those sorts of issues in philosophy of mind, and more interested in questions about you know, what could be the nature of sensations. And so although I wasn't working on qualia per se, still to me, it's the conscious mental states that are the ones that we really need to explain. And so in that sense, I was still doing the consciousness stuff. But I guess the thing that I brought forward with me from my undergrad years into grad school was a sort of dissatisfaction with functionalist theories in philosophy of mind, and that became the core of my dissertation project was a critique of functionalism that involved taking the notion of function very seriously, and that was. You know, something I learned about in graduate school was the whole debate in philosophy of science and in philosophy of biology in particular about different notions of function and biological function or teleological notions of function, evolutionary notions versus causal notions. And so I think it was during those years that I was able to make a switch from worrying about my dissatisfactions with functionalism by producing, you know, counterexample thought experiments that seemed where functionalism seemed to give the wrong answer, and switched over to a more internal critique of functionalism, where I was trying to work out what sort of notion of function one would have to use in order for functionalism, so understood, to actually deliver on the various promises that, that it made. Ultimately, in my dissertation, and then this is what got turned into my first book as well. I had sort of produced a huge taxonomy of different variations of functionalism, and then argued that there were a set of desiderata, of desirable features that it was supposed to have, and argued that there was no univocal notion of function that would allow us to formulate a theory of functionalism that had all of those features. So I took myself to be defending an identity theory about the mind by way of taking functionalism down a notch and arguing that although functionalism is, you know, a legitimate theory, it wasn't so obviously superior to the identity theory that the identity theory was dead in the water. And tried to do so as much as possible, not by trying to produce cases that and challenging the functionalists to explain them, you know, how do you explain, you know, qualia or whatever. But instead by trying to formulate functionalism more precisely, in terms of a notion of functional realization, and then what would that look like, and so on and so forth. And so that turned into the dissertation project.
Cool. How was it received?
Well, pretty well. The committee was supportive, even the ones who thought I was dead wrong were supportive. I worked out well. I mean, like most PhD students, I think I probably produced half to two thirds of what I originally planned to produce, and it was still a long dissertation. So I think, you know, like everybody else, you always think you're going to be able to do more than you can. And then you get into it and you find out, you encounter all sorts of difficulties you didn't foresee. And then the ones you did foresee take more work than you thought. And suddenly, you know, maybe you don't need eight chapters in your dissertation.
So you had that. I actually hadn't heard of that trend. I'm myself close to the point of working on working in a dissertation prospectus phase. So is that, I don't know if you've seen that amongst your students where they, I suppose they have these great ideas of, 400 page this or that or something like that.
Absolutely. It's always the case that I could speculate, I guess, about how it ends up that way. But I think it's very typical, especially in the early phases of dissertation planning, but even towards the end, that people are very ambitious. Students are ambitious and they're trying to take on more than they really are going to ultimately be able to do. And I think dissertation committees generally know this and don't expect that everything that gets proposed is going to make it into the final dissertation. I think part of it is, caused by students wanting to err on the side of being ambitious rather than not, right? I mean, you want to make sure you don't pitch yourself a softball and, you know, you take a substantial enough project. But it also has to do with, students having, the big idea, which is, that's what we're trying to do, right, is advance knowledge.
Yep.
But having the great idea, but also thinking that they have to arrive at the final conclusion in the dissertation rather than thinking that the dissertation can be one step towards establishing the big conclusion, or sometimes it's even a preamble to doing that. Yeah, I think it's not a bad thing that we're all ambitious, but I think it's also a normal thing that that the dissertation is doesn't do everything that it was initially planned. And of course, it also usually does some things that weren't initially planned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, all right. So, dissertation in hand, it seems you made it into a position in philosophy. Was this at the University of Cincinnati? Is that right?
I did. I came. I was not a tenure track position originally. I came to Cincinnati on a visiting position.
Great. Yeah. So, how did that work out?
Well, it worked out very well.
Well, but just like the logistics or like, you know, how did it transition into tenure track and everything?
Well, on the market that year, so I guess that was 2000, I had some interviews, and but I didn't get offered any of the jobs that I interviewed for at the APA that year. Mm-hmm. And so come the spring, I was, you know, looking for a visiting position, or, you know, shorter term position. And I had a couple different options, and one came up early, but I passed it up because it was not a location that I wanted to live, which is certainly a risky decision to make.
That's the decision you fear, I imagine, is having to.
I knew someone at a nearby university who was taking an administrative job and who had arranged for me to be her replacement during that time. So although I didn't have the written offer in hand, I had assurances that that I'd be able to take that job once it was available. And so I had a little bit of confidence that that I had a backup plan. But ultimately, I didn't end up taking that job because I did get the offer for a visiting position at Cincinnati before the other one materialized, and I thought it would be foolish to give up the bird in the hand twice. So, so I took the position in Cincinnati, and I came out here, and there was another visiting faculty member that year, a guy who was a Kant scholar. Mm-hmm. And then they also had just hired John Bickel as the department head. And I had known John had been at Eastern Carolina University, so I had known him a little bit when I was in graduate school. I'd met him a few times. So there were, I guess, then three new people showed up that year in Cincinnati, two visitors and John. And you know, I had a slightly heavier teaching load that year because I was a visitor. So, you know, most of my time was spent teaching and going back on the job market.
Sure.
And lucky for me, Cincinnati had advertised a couple of jobs, one in philosophy of science and one in ethics. And ultimately, I mean, it's sort of it's a little bit of a long story, but ultimately they decided to hire two philosophers of science rather than a philosopher of science and an ethicist that year.
A good decision. And, good decision.
Well, it worked for me, and so that was when Rob Skipper, philosopher of biology, was hired, and myself. So then it was 2001 when I started the tenure track job in Cincinnati, and I've been here since then.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, that maybe you can tell us about a little about. So I mean, it's been 17 years now. Have you had any favorite moments in Cincinnati at the university? I imagine, you know, over the maybe some of your, what was your earlier career like? You know, before pre-tenure.
It's been a very, very supportive place for me from day one. Like anybody showing up in a job, or most of us anyway showing up in a job, I had met one of my, you know, now colleagues at a conference once or twice.
Sure.
And like I said, I had met the department head a couple times, but you know, I didn't know anybody else in the city or at the university, but the faculty were all supportive from the first day. And in fact, you know, even before I had the tenure track job, there was no sort of second class citizenship for visitors. I mean, we were fully involved with teaching, and we were welcome to come to meetings if that's what we wanted to do, and participate in other faculty seminars and all that sort of thing. So it was really supportive. There was, you know, you're always thinking about what you need to do to get tenure, but there was never, I never felt like it was a sword hanging over my head or anything. You always got the sense that, you know, if you, you know, did your work and did good research and published some things, that it would probably work out, and it did for me. So I think the looking back, you know, one of the things I think about those years is that we were on a quarter system in Cincinnati, so we had three trimesters a year, and which was good in some ways, but it meant, you know, you taught a lot of different courses. And I think during that time when I was, you know, when people think of themselves as trying to get their careers ramped up and publish things, I was just teaching it, like, I think I taught like 20 different courses before I came for tenure. And I learned a lot, but in retrospect, I mean, I think I tell my junior colleagues now that they should, you know, repeat courses more often. But on the flip side, like I said, I mean, I was still learning a lot. I mean, not that I'm not now still learning a lot, but, you know, building a lot more breadth of knowledge, even by teaching.
You know, so I think I find it to be one of the best ways to learn is to teach a course you have no idea about.
Absolutely. And so I taught a variety of courses, both because, you know, you were always doing a new graduate course every year, rarely repeating a graduate course. And then teaching a variety of sort of regular undergraduate courses. And then we have an honors college here that allows us to apply to teach small, innovative classes. And so by myself and then sometimes with other faculty, I taught some of these honors courses and learned a lot doing that as well. For a while, I taught a course with a psychologist called The History of the Mind. And we did a history and philosophy of psychology course with a philosopher and a psychologist in the room. You know, all the time. So that was a great learning experience.
Yeah. How did the combination between, scientist and philosopher of science how did that work out?
It was fantastic. So the person I did this was is an ecological psychologist named Mike Riley. And he, you know, was already philosophically attuned and interested, and they had a course in their department that they was essentially a history and philosophy of psychology course that they were teaching on their own anyway. So to do it together and with you know, some smart undergrads was a real treat. And of course, there were, you know, things that I learned about, you know, how a psychologist thinks about the history of psychology and the trajectory of psychology that I wouldn't have known otherwise. And likewise, I think there were things that he learned about, you know, Hume or Locke that were different than what they said about Hume or Locke in a history of psychology class. So that was good. The only time we actually collaborated on writing something was just a little behavioral and brain sciences response piece where we actually had a third collaborator as well. But that really helped, you know, he and I to build a friendship and to grease the skids for further connections between our departments as time went on. So it was really nice.
Great. So, any other courses you taught, or you said you taught 20?
I taught all sorts of stuff. Nobody asks me to teach very much ethics, but I taught epistemology and metaphysics and philosophy of mind and several different intro courses. I taught philosophy of law once. I regularly taught a course that was a sort of technology, philosophy, and policy around technology that was aimed at engineering and computer science students. And as time's gone on, of course, I've taught more and more stuff. But in those early years, if it needed teaching, I'll teach that.
Well, that's great. That's great. So, as you're teaching all these things and as you're trying to get your research, I'm curious about, how your research focus or your ideas, shifted from time to time pre-tenure to tenure, what's going on in terms of your, approach to, and this might be something to say in terms of, were you considering yourself and doing, philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, a little bit of both,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there has definitely been a shift in my work towards philosophy of science. I mean, definitely in graduate school, I would have said I'm a philosopher of mind, mm-hmm. Or a philosopher of mind / psychology.
Yep.
And when I applied, as I did, for jobs that were philosophy of science jobs, I played up the fact that I had this background in cognitive science and that I had a background in philosophy of psychology in particular, but it was not the case that I would have thought of myself as a philosopher of science first, mm-hmm. At that time. But a number of things happened. One was that I arrived at a department in Cincinnati that was sort of even more naturalistically oriented and philosophy of science oriented than the one that I came out of at Duke. Paradoxically, because of that, I needed to do a bunch of teaching that was traditional philosophy that others weren't doing. So because there was so much philosophy of science, and for that matter, so much philosophy of mind available and with my other colleagues, someone needed to teach sort of traditional epistemology. Someone needed to teach traditional metaphysics. So on the one hand, I did that and learned more about those things and got drawn into having more metaphysical interests than my colleagues did. But by the same token, their influence on me for how they thought about minds and cognition and philosophy of science inserted more of that into my thinking as well. So that, relative to them, I was more metaphysics-y, but relative to everybody else who was doing metaphysics stuff, I was much more philosophy of science oriented.
Sure.
And in that process, I became, on the one hand, more dissatisfied with some of the kinds of arguments that I had found convincing earlier in my career, but also just got drawn into conversations philosophical conversations that were informed by more perspectives. So, in my dissertation, and which later was an article and not the whole dissertation. Dissertation, which later was a book, but I had a chapter on multiple realization, and it was almost a throwaway, just to get that sort of. It was something I needed to get past in order to talk about what I wanted to talk about, which was functionalism and the identity theory.
Yeah.
And but I ended up publishing that chapter as an article, and as it happened, there was a lot of discussion sort of suddenly blossoming about the very idea of multiple realization. And so, I would get invited to participate in a conference session or something like that. Huh. And suddenly I'm working a lot on multiple realization and talking to people who come from a more philosophy of science perspective. And so I got both pushed and pulled into thinking of it that way. Of multiple realization that way, and then of thinking of questions in philosophy of mind more generally as theoretical questions about the relevant sciences of the mind, which I was certainly primed for prior to that, coming out of cognitive science and with the background that I had, but it was definitely not explicit in the way that it's become
yeah.
For me to think about questions about the nature of minds as definitely questions about what the best theories are and relationship between sciences.
Sure. So, yeah, so what's so maybe you can tell us a little what's going on with this multiple realization book that you have, you know, with what co-writing with Lawrence Shapiro, who's done. I've seen the name around quite a bit. That's not Camaro. That's Shapiro. I was gonna mixed up. I'm like, he wrote the Radical Embodied Cognitive Science book. I'm like, nope, no, he didn't.
That one's my colleague, but
that's right. That's right. Okay.
At the time that I was finishing my dissertation and then set out to try to turn it into a book in those early years of my career, unbeknownst to me, Larry Shapiro was also working on multiple realization, and he published a paper in Journal of Philosophy in 2000, but I think I'm not sure how long it took me to come across that paper. And he too was writing a book that was partly about multiple realization. And although he and I had met previously, we hadn't sort of made any connection in general or on this work. But by like 2002, 2003, we had met at enough conferences talking about multiple realization and got to talking about it and found out that we had views that really fit together nicely and we agreed on quite a lot. And so we started collaborating on some conference papers and we thought about writing a book together but didn't really do anything about it for quite a long time. It was really one of those cases where, I mean, we've become terrific friends, but it really did start with discovering that we had this common interest and that we could each had some sort of philosophical resources in our work that the other could make use of. So we started out like that, and then around 2007 or so, decided that we should try to write a book together and outlined a book. But it ended up getting put on the back burner while he had some other projects and I had some other projects and then also had children, which sort of distracted me for a while. And, so we came back to it in earnest, just a few years ago. And by that time, you know, that many more years had passed of debates over realization and multiple realization, and what are they supposed to do, and you know, is it metaphysics, is it philosophy of science, is it philosophy of mind, is it philosophy of biology, all of those, some of them. We looked back at the sort of that couple different outlines that we had prepared of what sort of book we would write and realized that it was probably a good thing we hadn't written any of those books because they would have been really boring. And so started to think again about how we could bring all of our ideas together in one place. Mm-hmm. And the multiple realization book is the result of sort of just laying out how we think about these problems and how we think about questions in philosophy of mind and trying to put the phenomenon and the debate over multiple realization in philosophy of mind or in philosophy of science more generally in the context of choosing between sort of different worldviews, different theories about, in this case, minds and brains, but it could be about something else. So we develop our view in that context and make the case that when you think about questions about minds in that way, that then you need to examine the evidence rather carefully. And so we go through the exercise of examining good selection of evidence pretty carefully and trying to argue that it's representative and, that we can draw conclusions from it. And then extending our view to another sort of thing going on in philosophy during those years was that as a profession, we switched back towards cycled back towards a much greater sort of self-evaluation of our methodologies, right? And the whole philosophy of philosophy or meta-philosophy movement, you know, has become quite prominent. We have maybe me more than Larry, but we have some of that bug as well of trying to figure out, how the sorts of things that we're saying about philosophy of mind, psychology, and neuroscience generalize to other parts of philosophy, and then also generalize to philosophy itself, and understanding, how we have all of these different forms of inquiry and they interact with one another. So, the book takes, this sort of small specialized topic and tries to develop it in a way that that reveals why it's been thought to be traditionally important, and then provides an account that's somewhat deflationary, and therefore leaves us with some big questions about if the story that we're criticizing isn't the right one of how sciences are related to one another and how different sciences can each be legitimate forms of inquiry, then what's the right story? And then, for me, I think the next step is to, it's only hinted at in the book, is to ask the same questions about philosophy itself, about how philosophy is a form of inquiry and whether it's justified in the same way that the so-called special sciences are justified, or is it justified in some other way? So
what do you, you might have glossed over this or just explained this, but what can other from your positions in your book on multiple realization and reflecting on these, what can you say, or what lessons have you learned for philosophy as a discipline?
Well, so the sort of conventional or received view that comes in for criticism in our book is the view according to which the reason that we have lots of different sciences rather than one science, physics or whatever you want to call it, right? Rather than a reductionist view of sciences and the entities that they range over, the standard or received view is associated with Jerry Fodor and Hilary Putnam and Phil Kitcher is, well, it's because of multiple realization. Because of multiple realization, there are facts or generalizations or irregularities at the so-called higher level or second order facts or properties or processes that are heterogeneous with respect to the lower order or lower level facts of physics or whatever the relevant realizing science or set of stuff is going to be, and that explains why we have these special sciences. And we argue that that's not right. In particular, that it's not right about the relationship between psychology and neuroscience, but also that there are reasons to think that it's not right in general. Which is, by the way, not to say that it's not ever right, but just that it's not a universal explanation for why we have various sciences. And one thing you see right away is even if it were true that the reason that we have psychology in addition to neuroscience is that psychological processes are multiply realized by neural processes, that doesn't seem to tell us anything at all about why we have philosophy in addition to psychology or neuroscience. It doesn't seem to be the answer to the question, what makes philosophy a legitimate form of inquiry, to say, well, it's because the entities that philosophers study are multiply realized.
Yeah.
It's not that that's completely impossible. I think there probably are ways that you could develop that idea, but it's a strange thing to say. It's not the usual thing that people have said. So, looking back, it strikes me as pretty obvious that standard or received view, even if it were true for some sciences or for the sciences, wouldn't yet give us an adequate account of what makes philosophy a legitimate form of inquiry. And because I'm approaching this from, a broadly naturalistic framework, I'm not in a position to say, well, what makes philosophy legitimate is that We and only we study the necessary truths or the analytic truths or something like that. Because you know, sort of the kind of naturalism that I'm attracted to goes along with Penelope Maddy's idea that the naturalist has only one set of epistemic standards. There's just inquiry. And there's not one set of standards for necessary truths and another one for empirical truths or something like that. So for me, it's a legitimate and pressing question to try and say how this thing that we do, philosophy, can be itself a legitimate form of inquiry. I have to say the answer that Larry and I propose in our book for what legitimizes other sciences is also not an adequate answer for why philosophy is a legitimate form of inquiry, or at least it isn't taken at face value. So I think it's a I'm not a fan of everything that gets done under the guise of philosophy or metaphilosophy, but I think we have a legitimate question to answer, to give an adequate answer for or explanation of what it is we are doing.
And yeah, so and I'm reading just a little back here is where you offer an alternative framework for understanding explanations in cognitive science. So do you make it specifically, in terms of understanding, this is for the sciences themselves. So, and not necessarily philosophy. Maybe that's kind of woven in throughout. But what is this alternative framework? If you could.
Yeah. So we emphasize rejecting certain kinds of constraints on explanation that make it look as though you have to pick between competing or purportedly competing explanations. So ultimately, the approach that we're advocating is a kind of pluralism about explanation where there might be many adequate or good explanations for some phenomena, and you needn't have to choose, say, between the psychological explanation and the neural explanation, that they're not viewed as competing. And the framework that we used to justify that is drawn from Jim Woodward's work on causal explanation as an interventionist explanation. But the fundamental idea of that notion of causation or causation as manipulation or intervention is that causes are things that make a difference. So they're explanations in terms of difference makers. And so what we advocate is that it's at least a sufficient condition for the legitimacy of some explanation that it identifies difference makers for some regularity. Now, plainly, philosophy is not generally in the business of identifying causal difference makers. It may be that we can generalize that account to sort of other kinds of dependency relations other than just causal dependencies and thereby unify or at least some kinds of philosophical explanations with those of the special sciences. But at this point, I think that's a speculative proposal and not anything that we've worked out. I see some light at the end of that tunnel, but not there.
Well, I'm excited to hear. I'm excited to read the book. I'm hoping to sit in on this conversation in Colin's course. So, this looks like a very interesting read. And how's it been? I don't know. Yeah, I asked. Your dissertation seemed to be received well. How's this new book being treated?
It's early days, but so far so good. We had a very nice review in the Notre Dame Philosophical Reviews by Janet Levin, which was very appreciative of the book and I think represents us well. And we have actually two upcoming author meets critic sessions at conferences in the next 2 months. We have an author meets critics at the Southern Society for Philosophy of Psychology in Savannah, towards the end of this month, and then we have an author meets critic session at the Pacific Division APA meeting in Seattle next month. So I'm very pleased that we're getting some attention, and people that we've spoke to have, you know, even if they don't ultimately agree with us, feel like we're making a contribution, and that's you know, all you can hope for, really. I think, is to keep pushing the conversation forward and try and make some slow progress.
Fantastic. And so maybe you could tell me a little bit about the as we start to wrap up here, the Southern Society for Philosophy and Psychology that you served as president of.
Sure. So you're probably familiar that there is the Society for Philosophy and Psychology.
Yeah, I went to that last summer for the first time, which was very nice. But I've heard really good things about the Southern Society.
They're two different things, and the Southern Society name makes it sound like it maybe it's the regional version of the Society for Philosophy and Psychology.
Yeah.
But in fact, the 1S, SPP, came into existence in the mid-70s, and it's a great organization. The Southern Society is much, much older, and it goes back to the early 1900s, back to before the Journal of Philosophy and the Journal of Psychology were separate journals in the U.S. And it operates really right now as two parallel conferences, one in psychology and one in philosophy, with some overlapping sessions.
Oh, cool.
And so the philosophy is overwhelmingly philosophy of mind, psychology, language, epistemology, metaphysics, things that are sort of vague, or moral psychology, things that are in the vicinity of psychological interest. But over the years at that conference, there have been, sort of straight up sessions on the history of philosophy or things, quite distant from psychology. And the two halves of the meeting, the psychological group and the psychologists and philosophers, have varied in size. So I think when I first got involved in the 90s, the psychology side was quite large and the philosophy side was quite small. And these days, actually, it's the philosophy side which is quite large and the psychology side that's smaller. It's usually a 2 or 3 day meeting, and they have great invited speakers and sessions. And also, I think it's one of my favorite places to go and hear about good philosophy and talk to people. It's extremely friendly. Mm-hmm. Your audiences are tough but not hostile.
That's nice.
As a place to submit papers, I strongly encourage graduate students to submit papers, because it's the kind of venue that is selective enough, but it's not for free, and you're going to get. If you're accepted, you'll get some serious discussion, and if you're not, you'll get some feedback.
Oh, that's good.
But at the same time, it's not so demanding that you feel like you're tilting at windmills. So it has a sort of I think it's in that sweet spot of acceptance rates where enough are accepted that it's a worthwhile endeavor and not frustrating, but at the same time, the quality is quite high at the meeting itself. So, I think between the quality and they choose nice locations, and that's not to be undervalued. And
Savannah, Georgia. I don't know too much about that, but
it's a coastal city, and it has a large garden district and some wonderful food. And
oh, it looks beautiful. I'm just pulling up a picture now. Wow.
Yeah. So it's really a lovely it's a lovely place to be. Hopefully, for those of us who are from up further north, hopefully it'll be a little bit warmer than it is for us. And the meeting's usually a lot of fun.
Cool.
Good attendance from faculty and grad students, and a good mixture. So definitely, it's something to keep on your radar.
I'll share it with some folks. With similar interests in philosophy of cognitive science and philosophy of mind here at Indiana. And I'll certainly, if I can't go, this is like, oh man, I would love, if this was like in Louisville, I would be there in a second. At least this summer, but if not, definitely submitting next year would be definitely of interest.
Absolutely.
Well, we're getting to the end. And it's been great so far to hear about your story and your origins.
Well, thank you.
And thank you so much for, a very carefully and thoughtfully, giving some interesting insights into your new book, of which we sound very exciting. Is there anything, you want to share about yourself or, you know, University of Cincinnati or anything you want to plug or, graduate program there or anything at all you would want to leave us with?
Well, we do have a graduate program here, and I'd certainly, plug that. We would be a good fit for a lot of students. But one thing I would say that we touched upon earlier when you were talking, we were both talking about there being, it's sort of easier said than done to get a bunch of different people in a room and get them to talk to one another.
Yeah, that would be good to know. Yeah, let's revisit that.
I think one thing that didn't come up in our discussion is that I actually, when I was in graduate school, I spent about 4 years hanging out with a neurobiology lab, and I worked for them for one summer, but mostly it was just attending lab meetings and being part of discussions. And, I think the real lesson is it takes a while to work yourself into a place where scientists you can speak their language and they can take seriously your critiques and your questions.
Yeah.
And in my case, I did that by, just fortuitously finding someone who was interested in something that I was interested in. It turned out it was color vision.
Yeah.
And participating in the lab. And, you learn a lot by watching a lab group work and solve its problems and talk through what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. And establishing that rapport is really crucial. And when you have to do it on your own, it takes time. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that distinguishes our program here at UC, our philosophy PhD program, is we have what we call a philosophy and the sciences track in the program. And I think probably about half, maybe more than half of our students go in that direction. And those students are actually required to take a year's worth of graduate work in whatever science they're going to do philosophy of.
Oh, great.
And the good thing about that is, then you're not having to invent those connections from the ground up and go find someone to take you in. Where you can really take advantage of the relationships that are already built between our department and psychology or biology or anthropology. And in fact, more and more often, our students decide after they've done a year's worth of graduate work in the science, they might as well go ahead and get a master's in that science while they're on their way to the PhD. You can do it anywhere. If you find yourself someplace as a student or as a faculty member where the connections aren't already built for you, of course, you just have to find the right people and ask about until you get connected with them. But there are plenty of places, more and more places, where those connections are established. Of course, where you are at Indiana is one of them. We have that, we value that, and it's really that kind of investment that's been made by faculty and students who come before you makes it easier and easier for the next person to make those connections and more quickly come into a lab group or a research group and both be welcomed because they're not afraid of what they're getting into, but also to have, some of the initial discussion and vocabulary established so that the conversation can get started.
That's really great to hear. So do you have folks, some of your students, do they ever participate in lab meetings or do they ever join, neurobiology groups while working? Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. As I say, an increasing number of our students actually get the Masters of Science in biology.
Sure.
The ones we have going on right now are psychology, biology, and anthropology. Increasingly, they go ahead and get the Masters. So, of course, they're doing research, laboratory research. But even short of that, they are getting involved, and some of our job placements have been into either postdocs with we have one who's a postdoc here now in the psychology department here.
Oh wow!
But get hired at places where part of their job is to teach in either psychology or cognitive science. We did have someone who went on and got a postdoc in a neurobiology laboratory. They are, you know, minimally they're getting classroom exposure and getting, getting to know the other students, PhD students in psychology or biology, which of course is not just intellectually great, but socially great as well.
Oh, yeah.
But over and above that, you know, many of them are, yeah, they're participating in basic research in that discipline. And, sometimes we have, two of our faculty actually have joint appointments in philosophy and psychology, another one is doing some psychological research, but actually not. There is assistance from the psychology department, but the main collaborators are actually clinicians who are working with one particular autistic children, and they're doing some work with them. So, yeah, definitely. Classroom experience, but also first order experience with basic research, that's the way to build those relationships.
That sounds like a great place. I'll be sure to tell some folks about the University of Cincinnati, and if there's any up and coming undergraduates. It certainly seems like a great place to apply.
Come one, come all.
Yeah. All right, Tony. Well, Tom. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of your fellow. Is it Anthony Shimero? Is he also there at Cincinnati?
Yeah, Tony Shimero is one of our faculty who is split between philosophy and psychology.
That's right. I was.
Isn't he a Cog Sci PhD from
I think he was. I think I had met him coming over here, and I think he had mentioned Cincinnati. So. And something about being a joint appointment, which was interesting. So made me think of him. But Tom, it was a terrific to get to meet you and to get to chat, to hear your story along the way. I never actually got to hear. Did you ever come back to programming or anything along the way? Or ever finish those games?
I think, the extent of my programming these days is trying to get my web page to not completely crash.
Yeah, which is pretty tough sometimes. All right, fun. All right, well, thanks again so much for taking the time to chat. It's a lot of fun. Good luck with the responses for the new book. I hope those go really well. And hope we can cross paths soon.
Very good. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.